Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, episode number one. We are all apprentices in a craft where no one ever becomes a master. Ernest Hemingway.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to the show, guys. I'm so excited for this first episode of the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast. I really want to create a podcast that is dedicated strictly to the art and craft of storytelling, screenwriting, and the business of screenwriting. And this episode specifically is a crossover episode. It is going to be played both on my Indie Film Hustle podcast as well as on the Bulletproof Screenplay Podcast. So everybody from the Indie Film Hustle tribe can understand and get a taste for what the new podcast is all about. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you want to find out more information about our coverage service, just head over to covermyscreenplay.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Indie Film Hustle Pro, our private and growing community for filmmakers and screenwriters. It was created for film creatives like you to meet, network, and support each other, learn from film industry experts, and to get the answers to your burning questions and more. The journey in this business is rough. There is no guarantee to success, but your chances of reaching your goals dramatically improve when you find others who are on the same journey as you and you work together towards a common goal. That is why I put together IFH Pro. Inside, you'll get professional networking, private and safe spaces to discuss the film business, access to advanced tools and education, up-to-date education, exclusive content not available publicly, access to IFH Pro workshops, webinars, special guests, and so much more. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/pro. Now, if you haven't listened to episode 000, which is just basically what to expect, what this whole podcast is about, I'll give you a quick brief breakdown. Now, I know a lot of Film Hustle tribe members are going to go, Alex, we already listened to screenwriting stuff on the Indie Film Hustle podcast. Why are you creating a podcast just to talk about that? Well, I found out that many screenwriters in the tribe, you know, love the podcast, but, you know, have to wait a while before they get screenwriting and story episodes, as well as don't really want to know about self-distribution. Don't really want to know about cameras or lenses or visual effects or cinematographers or any of the other stuff that we talk about. They just want to focus on the craft of storytelling, screenwriting, and the business of screenwriting. So I decided, you know what? I'm going to create a brand new podcast that's going to be dedicated strictly to that. Now, I will be republishing many of the killer interviews that I had on the Indie Film Hustle podcast in regards to screenwriting and the business of screenwriting, but we're going to be doing all new interviews here as well. And I already have a ton of fresh new episodes waiting to be released. And because I'm launching a brand new podcast, I can't just launch with one episode, obviously. So we are going to have 6 new episodes right away. So if you're listening to this right now, you've got another 5 episodes that you can listen to right now. And I'll have 1 new episode every week. So if you are a Indie Film Hustle Tribe member and you have subscribed to that podcast, please go to screenwritingpodcast.com and subscribe to this podcast. And if you could do it today, that would be amazing, because the more subscribers I get in the first 6 weeks, the faster we can rank this brand new podcast on iTunes and get this information out to people and screenwriters who really, really need it. Now, today's guest is John Truby. John Truby has been Hollywood's premier screenwriting instructor and story consultant for over 25 years and has had more than 50,000 people attend his sold-out seminars around the world. He's been called one of the best script doctors in the film industry, and his former students' work have earned more than $15 billion at the box office, with movies like Ratatouille, Pirates of the Caribbean, X-Men 1, 2, and 3, Shrek, Sleepless in Seattle, and many, many more. And John is also the author of The Anatomy of Story, which is a best-selling book on the craft of storytelling. Now, after going through this interview with John, I mean, his perspective and his approach to storytelling is extremely unique, and his take on it, it just kind of blew me out of the water. I have never heard the kind of approach that he has been doing with his students for years. And it really kind of flipped my mind in regards to storytelling, because there are many different ways to tell a story. There are many different approaches to telling stories. No one is better than the other. They're all just different. And the more that we can learn from different mentors, writers, consultants, styles, the better we are as writers and storytellers. So John is definitely a unique perspective, and I cannot wait for you guys to hear this interview. And if you wait till the end of the episode, John has actually created a custom free worksheet that you guys can download, and we'll give you the link at the end. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with John Truby. I'd like to welcome to the show John Truby. Thank you so much for being on the show, John.
Great to be here, Alex.
I've been a big fan of your stuff for a long time, and I'm glad that you could get to bring some knowledge bombs to the Indie Film Hustle tribe.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of indie film, and so anytime I can help out in that area, promote the making of good indie films, I think that's the future of the film business. And so anytime I can help out there, I'm happy to do it.
Thanks again. So let's get to it. I wanted to ask you, first and foremost, a very strong question. Why do most people fail at screenwriting?
I think the reason most people fail at screenwriting is they don't know what the screenwriting business is looking for. Mm-hmm. And I emphasize that word business. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the proper training to provide what the screenwriting business is looking for. So you have a massive mismatch between what people are writing and what Hollywood or indie film producers want to buy. Mm-hmm. And this is why 99.9% of screenwriters fail in trying to get their work out to the world. We know that the film business and television are very competitive. Relatively few films are made, but you have much less chance of succeeding in that environment if you don't know the kind of story and the kind of story techniques that create a script that they want to buy.
It's a very good point, and it's something that I agree with you 110%.
Yeah, I mean, and it goes to a deeper issue of that writers tend not to, you know, they're so involved in the writing, and we can all understand that because writing is incredibly hard.
Very much so.
So involved in the writing that they fail to see that it's, first of all, a business. Mm-hmm. If you want to just write for yourself, that's fantastic. But if you want to sell what you write, then you've got to, first of all, understand that it is a business and understand what the business is looking for.
Now, in your opinion, what are the building blocks of a good story?
Well, there's a ton of techniques for good story. And, you know, I've tried over all my years of teaching story classes to go into those in great detail and mm-hmm. try to be as specific as possible. I'm a real stickler about technique. Mm-hmm. I feel that a lot of times writers read these books about screenwriting, and they're very theoretical, esoteric, and we all nod our head and we say, yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. But when it comes time to the blank page, what do I do? You know,
and then, that blinking cursor is the worst thing in the world.
Exactly. And if you don't have real specific techniques to get you through that, to take you step by step through that process, you've got no chance. But really, I like to bring all of those techniques under one umbrella, which is the umbrella of narrative drive. Mm-hmm. The single most important element in popular storytelling, not just in screenwriting, but in worldwide storytelling in every medium, mm-hmm. is narrative drive. And most writers do not know how important narrative drive is, mm-hmm. especially in Hollywood screenwriting. And if they do know the importance, they don't know how to execute it. And when I say narrative drive, first of all, a lot of people do not understand the term. Mm-hmm. What narrative drive is a story with nonstop excitement. It's the forward propulsion of the story that makes the reader, the script reader, want to turn the page. And this is by far the most important thing when it comes to selling your script.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I always like to say Hollywood has three things above all that they're looking for in a script. Mm-hmm. Narrative drive, and narrative.
Okay.
I'm trying to get across the importance of this concept. And so it's this forward propulsion of the story. It's what makes it a page turner. Now, there are a lot of specific techniques that go into getting narrative drive. But then this brings in the other point that I was just making, which is that writers typically do not get the proper training to get that narrative drive. And we all know what I'm talking about. Basically, writers in, you know, the current screenwriting world use two fundamental methods. The first is three-act structure, mm-hmm. and the second is hero's journey. Mm-hmm. Now, I contend that if you're using three-act and hero's journey, that's great if you're a beginner. That's great when you're first starting to write because you face that overwhelming pressure, that overwhelming difficulty of climbing this mountain. Mm-hmm. See, I don't know how to do it. And along comes three-act and hero's journey and says, oh, it's real simple. Like, there's just three acts and two or three plot points and so on. And it makes you feel you can do it. Mm-hmm. And there's real value in that. But in my opinion, these two structure methods will really hold you back if you want to be a professional. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of reasons for it. First of all, everybody uses these, which means that all those scripts are the same. And it means that all those scripts are boring, okay. because we've seen it 1,000 times or more. Now, the first and most important thing in terms of setting yourself apart from everybody else, which is the key to being a professional writer, it's establishing your unique story brand. You can't do that if you're writing a script that looks like everybody else's script. You've got to come across with something that's really unique, that only you can provide that producer, that audience. They now, have to come to you.
Now, a question I ask, though, is when you apply the hero's journey to multiple big, you know, almost all the big budget films and big budget blockbusters, they all seem to line up. But are you saying that there's other things within that structure that's working that we're not seeing?
Absolutely. There's a number of things, and that's a great question. Let me get into it.
Okay.
First of all, you can say the same about three-act structure. You can say, well, you know, look at all these blockbuster films. They all break into, you know, three acts, apparently. Mm-hmm. Well, to which I always reply, you can divide anything into three parts. That doesn't mean it's going to help you write it. What people understand is the three-act structure was invented by a story analyst to analyze a script after it was written. And so it was simply an aid to say, okay, you know, this happens in the first act, this happens in the second act, and so on, which is simply a glorified way of saying beginning, middle, and end. Mm-hmm. Same thing is true about Hero's Journey. There are certain beats that you see from the Hero's Journey that are in most blockbuster films. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't tell you that all the other techniques that that writer had to know and apply to make that a script that, first of all, would sell, and second of all, would have blockbuster potential. Mm-hmm. There's another point, too. What people don't tell you when they're talking about three acts, excuse me, when they're talking about the hero's journey, is that this is not a story structure that applies to all stories. The writer's journey applies when you're writing a myth story, and very specifically when you're writing a male myth warrior story. Right now, you look at these blockbuster films, a lot of them, in fact, the vast majority of them, are male warrior myth stories. And the reason for that is that Hollywood is very conscious of the fact that there are certain genres that travel the world better than other genres. The genre that travels the world better than any other form, that is popular in all countries around the world, regardless of language, regardless of culture, is a myth story. Mm-hmm. So Hollywood, because they sell to a worldwide market, they like to use that form. And I always tell people, and I talk heavily about genres, because genres are really the key to your success in this industry, mm-hmm. that if you want the best chance of writing a blockbuster story that will sell to Hollywood, at least one of the genres that it should be based on is myth, because it is the best traveled story form there is. The problem is, number one, that, as I mentioned just a moment ago, those beats of the hero's journey don't give you anywhere close to the techniques you need to know to write a successful male warrior myth that's different from everything else we've seen before. You can't just write another Star Wars and expect to sell that.
Right.
But the other thing is, what if you're not writing a male warrior myth? What if you're writing a love story, a detective story, a thriller, and so on? The hero's journey does not work for that. And if you try to impose that template on those genres, you're going to have big problems. And here's the point. Each genre is a specialized plot form. And so what each does is each genre has anywhere from 8 to 15 specialized plot beats that you have to know, and you have to hit those beats. And even more importantly, you have to twist those beats to do that plot form in a unique way we haven't seen before. So even if you were to write a hero's journey myth story, if you don't know how to twist those beats to do it in a special way, it's not going to sell. It's not going to even come close. Again, we've got to bring in originality to what is a generic way of telling stories. So my basic point is that these techniques, these basic structural methods, are good when you're first starting out. But you've got to go way past that if you want to work at the professional level, meaning you are one of maybe one half of 1% who is working in that arena. And that's why I put so much emphasis on the techniques of narrative drive, regardless of the genre, regardless of the medium. These are the elements that really make a difference in your story. Now, when we talked about coming on your show, mm-hmm. I decided to put together a story improvement worksheet mm-hmm. that would have a number of these techniques in there and a place for writers to actually write how they execute that technique mm-hmm. on worksheet. Mm-hmm. And one of the first ones that is in there is the desire line of the hero. What the hero wants in the story. And it's interesting, Alex, I do my story class all over the world. Mm-hmm. And when I give the class outside of the United States, I always ask the students, What do you think is the main reason that Hollywood films are the most popular movies in the world by far? And they give me two answers invariably, no matter what country I'm in. Okay. It's always the same two answers. The first is you have all the movie stars.
Okay. Right?
And that gives me the opportunity to tell them that Hollywood has not been a movie star-based business for 20 years.
Yes.
The only guys that don't know that it's no longer a movie star-based business is the movie stars.
Right.
Okay. It's a story-based business. And more specifically, it is a genre-based business. The other answer they always give me is, you spend so much money on special effects. And of course, they point to all the big blockbuster films with all that money that was spent on special effects. That gives me the opportunity to point out to them all the movies that bombed at the box office that spent a ton of money on special effects, because that has nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then I get to tell them the real reason, the number one reason why Hollywood movies make more money than any other film in the world is in the script.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And it is the desire line of the hero. In Hollywood movies, you have a single hero who has a very specific desire that he goes after with incredible intensity. Mm-hmm. Because what that desire line does is give you the spine of the story. And then it's all about, will that character succeed in getting the goal? And it doesn't matter what country I live in, I want to see that character succeed. And it's that desire line, that very intense, specific desire line, that gets me on board the thrill ride. And that's what Hollywood movies really are, in terms of when we're talking about popular movies. Right now, this is not necessarily the case with indie films, but when we're talking about Hollywood mainstream films, they are a thrill ride, the equivalent of a thrill ride, what used to be known as the e-ticket ride in Disneyland.
Right.
Right. And the way they get it, they do a lot of techniques again, but the first way they do it is with a single hero with a driving desire. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. What about the Avengers? What about these, you know, these teens, the Justice League, and so on? Guess what? All they've done is they've taken a number of heroes, turned them into a team, and that team becomes the single desire, the single hero, and the team goes after a single goal with incredible intensity. And in the worksheet that I put together, I have in there. There's a test that you do in your own school to see if you have a single desire line that is specific enough to carry the weight of the entire story. And that test is, there must be a moment at the near the end of the story when the audience knows, yes or no, the hero either got the goal or they lost the goal. Now, obviously, 9 out of 10 times in Hollywood movies, they're going to get the goal. Mm-hmm. But structurally, it is not necessary that they get the goal. But what is important to remember is this spine, this goal of the hero, is the thing that you hang every other story element on top of. Mm-hmm. Which is why when you're writing that script, that is the first thing you've got to figure out. Because everything else will come off of that.
Now, so what makes a character interesting to an audience? Is it just this drive, or is what are some elements that make characters interesting?
Great question. One of the reasons is the particular desire that they have. Mm-hmm. Because when a character has a very specific goal, especially if it's a difficult goal to achieve, that's one of the ways the audience identifies with that character, because if that character wants the goal that much, and I know precisely what goal they want, then I want them to win that goal too. So I get invested in it as well. When I get my story class, I talk about The desire line is the tracks of the train. And when once we set up that goal at the end of the journey, it's like the audience gets on the train with the hero and we all go after it together. So that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. There's a second element that is extremely important in creating a character that the audience cares about. And that is that we have to give them a weakness, at least one major flaw that is holding them back from success. Not just success in getting that goal, it's holding them back from success in life. This is a flaw that is so serious that it is ruining their life. And it's actually established even before you establish the desire line of the hero. Now, a lot of people hear that and it's counterintuitive. They say, well, you know, why would I want to see a guy with a problem, a weakness like that? Well, it is a real interesting test where you see this go on. You see the power of this concept. For many years, James Bond franchise was the most popular franchise in the history of film.
Mm-hmm.
Massively successful.
Mm-hmm.
But when we got up into the 20s of the number of Bond films that were, it started to get a little tired, right? And it essentially became, each film became basically a stunt film.
Mm-hmm.
And the only question in that film was, is this set of stunts going to be better than the ones that were in the last Bond film?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Absolutely zero story quality. And then they decided to make Casino Royale, which was the origin film of James Bond. And they did one thing above all else that made all the difference in the world. They gave James Bond, who until that point had been a superhero, and in fact is the most popular superhero in history, they gave him both a psychological and a moral flaw.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they took his strength, right? Besides being this, you know, incredible, you know, intelligence guy who does all these action stunts. He's physically very good.
Mm-hmm.
But they took his great strength. He's a ladies' man.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ultimate ladies' man. They turned that into a flaw, and they made it a deadly flaw. Because James Bond fooling around with women, especially married women, in that film, he gets a married woman killed. And all of a sudden, we see that this ladies' man quality is actually built on a deep flaw that's been there for a long time, since he was young, and it represents a coldness, an inability to love. And so what do they do in that picture? They have James Bond fall in love. Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
James Bond in love, and of course, the lover turns out to be one of his opponents. So you get this massive betrayal. So the point is, by setting up this great flaw, both psychological and moral, in this character,
mm-hmm.
instead of making the character less popular, which is what they'd been afraid of, because the conventional wisdom in Hollywood for decades was, when you have an action hero, they've got to be perfect. They've got to be a paragon of virtue.
Muscle-bound, right?
Yep. Exactly. And instead, they reversed it. And they said, no, we're going to give him flaws. And guess what? That made James Bond far more popular. And you know why? It's because Casino Royale was a great story.
Yeah, it was. It was excellent.
And that's the difference. And so the two main things that you're looking for, and again, there are many other techniques, but the two most important for caring for a character. And by the way, this, again, goes against conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Most writers, when they're creating their characters, they basically try to come up with a list of traits, characteristics, what is their job? How much money do they make?
Mm-hmm.
How do they dress? What's their favorite color? You know, it goes on and on. Well, these are all superficial and make virtually no difference in terms of the connection between the audience and the character.
Mm-hmm.
By far, the two most important things to establish in that character, and you do it right at the beginning of the story, is what is their great flaw and what do they want? And if you do that, you've got 90% of the viewers right there.
Now, there's a movie that I always use as a reference as I argue one of the best written movies of all time, Shawshank Redemption, which is – it's fascinating because I was in high school when it came out, and at that time I thought Jean-Claude Van Damme was the greatest actor of all time. So back in the day when you were kids, but that movie cut through all of that. And even at that moment, myself, my group of friends, everyone just loved that movie. And there was something so primal in the storytelling that it's now considered one of the greatest films ever made, but it took a while for people to catch up to it. What do you think is the key to that specific film with Andy Dufresne and his journey? I'd love to hear your take on why you think that story resonates so powerfully with audiences around the world.
Well, I agree with you. It's a great choice. It's a terrific film, terrific story. And it, not surprisingly, there are many story elements that are going into that success. One of the reasons that it was overlooked in terms of how great it was at the time is because they do it so effortlessly. Mm-hmm. It's like Michael Jordan playing basketball. Well, you figure, well, the guy's just got great physical skills. No, you don't have any idea of the kind of technique that is sitting underneath those skills. Mm-hmm. The great writers will do that. Again, there's tons of reasons. You have a terrific main character.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You have the use of which is a lot of people don't even consider this as part of the success. In fact, it goes against conventional wisdom, mm-hmm. which is that it has a storyteller,
right?
A voiceover narration.
Yeah, narration according to McKee is horrible.
Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. This is complete nonsense.
Right.
It's complete. Some of the greatest Hollywood films ever
have narration in it.
Voiceover narration.
Of course.
Yeah. When voiceover narration is used to hide mistakes in the story, and because when they made the film, they screwed it up. Right. And so now they have to patch it with this voiceover. Yeah. Then you've got a big problem with voiceover narration.
Or backstory, or anything like that. They kind of stick in there. Sure.
Exactly. But if it's part of the story structure from the beginning, if it's there for a reason, then it can really kick up a certain story, can kick it up to another level, which it did in this case. Because notice that we don't just really care about Andy. Mm-hmm. We care about the voiceover narrator. I can't remember his character's name.
Red,
exactly.
Of course, Morgan Freeman, yeah.
And that, because we're coming at it from his point of view, third-person point of view, it also hooks us with much less screen time into liking Red. Mm-hmm. And another big part of it is the friendship between them.
Mm-hmm.
White guy, black guy. Right? Mm-hmm. They don't hit you over the head over it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can bet that is a big part of the success of that story in terms of making us feel good that these two guys succeed.
Now, who's the main character of that movie? Is it Red or is it Andy?
Well, this is really interesting because one of the things I talk about in my advanced story class is that when you have a storyteller, the storyteller is the true main character of the story.
Right.
And which indicates that Red is actually the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And if you track the structure beats of that story, you see that he hits all of those structure beats that make him the main character. But it's a very similar structure to The Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
Nick is talking about Gatsby. Now, when people think about The Great Gatsby, they think, well, Gatsby's obviously the main character.
But structurally,
he's not. Mm-hmm. Nick's the main character. And one of the interesting things that I can't remember the directors who did the most recent Gatsby.
Baz Luhrmann.
Exactly. One of the things he did was increase considerably the storyteller frame that Nick has on screen, much more than in the novel. Mm-hmm. And that's because the journey, the psychological and moral journey that's going on there is not Gatsby. Mm-hmm. Gatsby basically falls, and we feel sorry that he does because he was, you know, he's basically cheating. But the guy who makes the journey in the story is Nick. Mm-hmm. And Baz Luhrmann understood that. But so that's another important element of Shawshank Redemption. I would contend that the most important is it has a great plot.
Oh God, it's so beautifully written. Frank Darabont was so good. Yeah.
Oh. Just terrific. And Alex, this is something that is so important because I tell everybody in my classes, the single biggest problem that writers have in screenwriting and every other story medium today is they don't know how to plot. It's not character, it's not dialogue, it's plot.
Is that different than structure?
It is different than structure. It's okay. Closely connected to structure, but it's different from structure. And let me explain.
Okay.
Plot has more techniques that go into a good one than all of the other story skills combined. And it's not even close. And the problem with it is not only is plot extremely complicated to do as a writer, it's very difficult to teach. And here's the reason. Most people think about plot as the character overcoming a series of obstacles mm-hmm. over the course of the story. And what that means is they think of it in a tactical way, in the sense of they think of it as these individual moments when the hero overcomes an obstacle. Mm-hmm. And basically, especially if you're using hero's journey, what you do is you simply string a series of obstacles that he overcomes along the way. Well, big mistake. What you've just done is committed what I consider to be the cardinal sin of storytelling, which is a cardinal sin of plotting, which is you're hitting the same beat. It's you repeating the same beat, because even though that might be a different opponent that you are overcoming at each obstacle, it's basically what's happening there is the same basic action. And so you string too many of those together and you get an episodic plot, a boring plot.
Yeah.
Now, how do we contrast that? We contrast that to a grand plot where all of the obstacles and opposition are connected under the surface and designed in such a way that this opposition builds over the course of the story. And what a really great plot is, instead of coming at it from the tactical point of view, you have to come at it from the strategy point of view, because a plot is a grand strategy that the opponent and the author use to put the hero in the greatest possible trouble. So instead of looking at each of these moments as a single event, you have to look at your plot as this grand sequence there where all of these elements are connected together, most of them under the surface. Now, that's very hard to do. It's also very hard to teach, mm-hmm. which is why when people, for example, they do the hero's journey or the three-act structure and so on, they don't get this training. So, of course, they're not going to be able to do that. And what do? They execute these simple structures. They think, you know, I'm doing what the books tell me to do. And they don't come up with a great plot. And then guess what? They think, well, it must be my fault. Mm-hmm. I don't have the talent. Well, it's not the fact that you don't have the talent. It's the fact that the tool that you're using is not advanced enough to give you an advanced level plot. And what plot really is it's made up of a number of components. I mentioned them a little while ago, mm-hmm. the first and most important, which is the desire line.
Sure.
In order to hang this sequence of oppositions that puts the hero in the greatest possible trouble, you have to hang it on a spine. So that's the goal that the hero has, if you can take him from beginning to end.
So it's kind of like what Hitchcock did in most of his big movies, is he has that MacGuffin and the character trying to get that MacGuffin, and it's just a strong need, and everything is dangled and hung on that very strong narrative.
Exactly. MacGuffin is simply a term for a desire line where it's not that important whether the character gets the goal or not, but we have to have a spine to hang everything else on.
If we don't have a goal to go forward, there's no story.
Right. And there's no opposition, because this concept of the plot, as I mentioned right at the beginning, you have to start with the desire line because everything comes off of that. Mm-hmm. But another thing that I have in the story improvement worksheet that I put together for your people has to do with the opposition. Until you know the desire line, you can't come up with the opponent. And you don't know exactly who they are, and this has to do with a structural definition of opponent. A lot of writers get this wrong, right? They think the opponent is the villain. He's the bad guy. Okay, well, sometimes he is a villain, but sometimes he's not. That has nothing to do with structurally what makes an opponent. Mm-hmm. An opponent is a character who wants to prevent the hero from getting his goal. Period.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So by that definition, opponent could be a better human being than a hero could be. And this is one of the things we see in advanced storytelling. Oftentimes, the opponent is a better human being. Mm-hmm. But what makes him an opponent is that he's on the other side of the goal. And in fact, he is competing with the hero for the same goal. Because this puts the hero and opponent into a necessary opposition. In other words, they have to fight. Mm-hmm. Now, you hear that and you think, well, that's kind of obvious, right? Mm. But believe me when I tell you that I see loads of examples. The hero and opponent do not want the same goal, and the writer then doesn't understand, why can't I not create conflict and build conflict? It's because if you have a hero and opponent who are going after a different goal, it is entirely possible for them to go after those goals without coming into direct conflict. The only way you can make sure that they come into direct conflict and that conflict builds over the course of the story is if they want the same thing. And then they're going to fight about it, and that fight is going to get nastier and nastier and nastier until you have a final battle at the end which decides the issue. So this then is you get this opposition, which then is the second major element to great narrative drama.
So I'll go back to Shawshank, the main villain of that movie, among the other minor villains, is the warden, who's stopping Andy from just living, let alone trying to escape. He had no chance to escape. Right. He's just like being a human being. So what is the goal? What are the same goals? Because Andy obviously has different goals than he does, but yet they conflict so much. So what is that? How is that? Can you explain that?
Well, again, great question. A lot of people, when they hear that the hero and the opponent have to compete for the same goal, they'll go to a detective story and say, wait a minute, they don't compete for the same goal. The bad guy has committed a murder, he's trying to get away with it, and the detective is trying to figure out who did it.
Yeah, Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes.
Right. Now, and then when the writer tries to write their own detective story, again, they don't understand, why can't I make this thing work? Why can't I make this opposition in this work? It's because that's not what a detective story is. They're really fighting about. Detective and the killer are fighting about whose story will be believed. And what they do is each takes the same set of physical clues and creates a story. Detective story is about competing artistic stories. It's not about, the killer and the dead guy and all the looking for and asking questions and finding out who did it. It's about which story will be believed, the villains or the heroes. And so this leads to one of the key rules about good detective writing is every physical clue that you put in the story has to have at least two possible interpretations. This is one reason why detective stories have the most complex plot of any genre there is. Mm-hmm. And by the way, just to go back to an earlier point, why if you try to do a detective story using the hero's journey, good luck, you will die.
You won't. No, and actually, I've never actually even thought about it that way. But you're right, because I've been in the camp of hero's journey three act structure, and I know there's four or five act structure, and other and Raiders of the Lost Ark is what five acts.
Some have said that. I think. Even trying to do that, you've already lost the battle because it's totally arbitrary. For example, I was on a panel once with three other fairly well-known story gurus, mm-hmm. and I use that term loosely because I despise the word. but one of the teachers up there said, this person is a very strong advocate of three act structure, said, she acknowledged the fact that Shakespeare wrote in five acts. Mm-hmm. And she said, what Shakespeare really meant to do was to write in three acts. Okay.
So now she's reinterpreting Shakespeare.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
You see the absurdity of it.
Yes, I got you. Yes. Yeah. It's a mouse throwing stones at a lion. Got it.
Right, exactly. But it's also the absurdity of trying to divide into numbers, whether it's three parts, four parts, five parts, eight parts. Mm-hmm. You can divide any unit into any number of pieces. The question is, does the dividing of that give you techniques to actually write it in such a way that it feels like it's all of one piece that builds steadily to a climax at the end? Mm-hmm. And my point is that certainly something as simplistic as a three-part division is not going to get you anywhere close to the ability to write a Shawshank Redemption. Mm-hmm. There's no technique there. It's like what Gertrude Stein said about Oakland. There's no there there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing
there
you can use, right? And as I said at the beginning, I'm all about the practical. I'm all about specific techniques that if I do this in the story, I will get this emotional effect in the audience.
So you're absolutely right. You can't, you know, you can cut anything into as many parts as you want, but at the end of the day, it's all about the story and it's all about how it's moving that drive through it.
Exactly. It's all about how are all the elements contributing to the overall narrative drive of that story? Because the audience isn't looking at it and say, well, that was a great first act.
Right. Cool.
Yeah. He's good. This guy's good.
Yeah. Only in L.A.
Right. In L.A. But no, they're sitting there. They're on the thrill ride. They want the propulsion. They want the speed, right? And so they don't know the techniques that are going there. They don't know the techniques that are putting them there. But we as writers have got to know those techniques. So like, we create it.
So like thinking about a screenwriter like Chris Nolan, who is obviously a master at what he does in his storytelling craft, you take a script like Memento or Inception, which has – it's just layer on top of it. Makes my head hurt thinking about the layers that are on that and how he's able to bring, or Pulp Fiction. I mean, that's another one that was just this.
Yeah.
You could break that into three act structure.
You could. But what would it do for you? What would it do for you? I prefer to break it into the elements that really made a difference.
Which are?
So for example, I love the fact that you're talking about Chris Nolan. Mm-hmm. Chris Nolan and his brother are the number one in terms of the ability to create plot in popular movie today. Mm-hmm. Number one, they are plot masters. And their biggest problem that no one else in the world has is they're so good at plot that they create too much plot sometimes. They sometimes do, yes. Right? They sometimes do. But what I always tell writers is we should all have that problem.
Right. It's like, right. I don't want to get too big if I go to the gym.
Right.
I don't want to get too shredded.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I say if when you can write plot like Chris Nolan, then come to me and we'll give you a few things that'll fix it.
They'll tone it down.
I don't think you're going to be coming to me. I really don't. but no, I mean, you look at the way that he structures these stories and the way he uses plot. Mm-hmm. You can see, if you break it down, you can see the grand strategy that the author and the main opponent are using. Let me give you a perfect example of this. In The Dark Knight, greatest superhero movie ever made.
I would agree with you on that.
And there is no competition for that. It is the best. If you look at the plot of that story,
it's deep.
It's very deep. It's very complicated.
Yes.
And yet probably a little too complicated, but I'm fine with that. But if you break it down structurally, you will find that this plot is built on a sequence of tests, moral tests, that the Joker forces Batman to solve.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And these tests become more and more difficult.
Intense,
leading to the final test with where we have the two ships,
mm-hmm.
where he used the classic, from game theory, the classic prisoner's dilemma in order to create this scene. And what and why is the Joker forcing Batman through these tests, besides the fact that the greatest opponent will test the hero to the deepest possible level? It's because he's trying to prove his view of humanity, which is that man is simply another animal with a thin veneer of civilization, and I'm going to scratch that thin veneer and show you he's just a dog-eat-dog animal like everybody else, like every other creature. And he happens to be wrong. But what he does is, and what the Nolans do there, is by giving Batman these series of more complex moral tests each time, they're tightening the vise. They're making, okay, all right, you solved that one. Now let's turn the screws a little more. Now, how are you going to do this one? And this is the kind of this, and this also points up the essential difference between plot and structure. Because structure is simply plot that forces the hero to deal with his weakness. That very first step that I mentioned that you established for the character.
Mm-hmm.
Because the weakness, both psychological and moral, this weakness is the driving force. It is the first cause of everything. In fact, that weakness is what the story is really designed to solve. And how do we solve it? We force the hero to go on a plot journey, go after a goal,
mm-hmm.
puts pressure on him at an increasing rate until he is forced to confront that weakness. And he either solves that weakness or he fails. And that happens at the end of the story. And it happens right after he accomplishes or fails to accomplish his goal.
Can you even give another example of a movie that does what you just said? Because I'm rattling my head like, where have I seen a movie? And I know there exists, but I can't think of one that exactly that happens. That the villain is testing the hero again and again and again till the final crescendo of the finality. I'm assuming Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes at a certain point do that.
Well, I mean, you know, start with that. I mean, it's. Why was Moriarty created? It comes down to what I consider to be one of the most important of all story principles, which is the hero is only as good as the person he fights.
Yeah.
You want a great hero, you have to have a great opponent. And you have to have an opponent who is equal to that hero.
That's
possibly, even at the beginning, more powerful than the hero lives.
That's, and now we'll go off on a tangent here, but I think that's one of the reasons why DC is having such a difficult time with telling stories other than Batman, because Batman is the only Marvel character in the DC universe that has flaws, but everyone else is a god. So that's why Superman is such a difficult character to write for.
You have absolutely nailed the difficulty of any superhero franchise. Mm-hmm. And is why Batman Dark Knight is the best superhero movie ever for a lot of reasons. But the main reason, he's got a psychological and moral flaw, and he's human. Mm-hmm. If you have a superhero who is a god, and especially one like Superman, where he's just a straight up super fine guy, what do you got? What are you going to do with that?
I'll throw kryptonite at him again and again.
Yeah. And that is a physical, that's simply a physical object that can attack him.
Yeah. Lex Luthor never was a challenge. It doesn't have the Joker Batman dynamic doesn't have the same thing as the Superman Lex Luthor. Cause Lex Luthor arguably is his Joker, right. but it was just like, God, the movies.
But look at the difference right there. Mm-hmm. Lex Luthor is of course Moriarty.
Right.
And what we're trying to do is create a villain who is at a high intellectual level, who is capable of challenging that superhero to the greatest possible degree.
Right.
And that's fine, except that if the superhero is a god without a moral or really even a psychological flaw, mm-hmm. then the only way that that villain can test him is on the intellectual level, is can I – create crime that you can't deal with, that you can't solve in some way.
That's emptier, though.
It's totally empty. It's like, okay, is Superman going to succeed or not? Well, obviously he's going to succeed. So, you know, it's just spinning wheels. Right, and that's why until they do a superhero movie of another superhero who has the kind of moral and psychological complexity of a Batman, mm-hmm. nobody else is going to come close to that film.
Well, the only one I can even think of that I remember is the Superman 2 back mm-hmm. in the day with right. Richard Donner's one. That was a great example of like, okay, you've got Superman. He's the Boy Scout. Well, what do? You give him three super people to fight, and he gets tested along the way, and then you take away his superpowers. Right. So now he's human. So it's like that dynamic was – it's probably one of the best Superman stories told on cinema. Do you agree?
Yeah, But let's take this story problem out to the larger issue of if you're doing any franchise, because Marvel has the same problem.
Oh yeah,
Marvel's had has been more successful than DC Comics and Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. However, they've got the same problem. When you have superheroes who are gods who cannot be killed, mm-hmm. then what do you do? Well, the main thing you do is you try to come up with a new villain that's really, really tough and he's really smart and he can really test them. Okay, but that gets repetitive real fast. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what are the best Marvel films? They are films where they take the team of these superheroes and they put them in conflict. That's mm-hmm. why a guy like Joss Whedon, when he wrote, I can't remember which
The Avengers he did. Yeah.
Right. Why that was so smart was he was coming from TV. Mm-hmm. TV has the best storytelling in the world today, by far. Mm-hmm. It has dwarfed film in terms of quality, and it has for the last 15 years. All right, one of the techniques that he brought over from television, it was when you have a series, and that's what these franchises are. You have a series, you have serviced the main characters. So, for example, you have ER, you have five leads, mm-hmm. right? The juice of the show doesn't come from each patient, anonymous patient that comes in every week that we help, that we heal. No, it has to come from the conflict within these leads. These leads are all part of a family, but we have to make them fight with each other because that's where the juice is. That's exactly what Joss Whedon did when he wrote The Avengers. Mm-hmm. He tried to create conflict among these characters that we love who are part of the family. That's why it was a better story. Yeah, he still had the outside opposition, mm-hmm. still had to pay those dues, but the juice of it was in here.
Can they even get together long enough to defeat the bad guy?
Exactly.
Which is a much more powerful, arguably, than what they are.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's why something like Winter Soldier, Captain America Winter Soldier, is probably one of the best Marvel movies, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because of the way they structure that story and what those guys are doing. We're going off on a tangent, but what those guys did with Civil War and all that kind of stuff.
Just to dot that I, but it is precisely the same technique. It's we take our heroes, we put them into the main conflict.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the audience loves to see, because they're characters that we've invested in. I don't care about this new opponent. He's just there to create the overall jeopardy.
So then why did Civil War work so well and become such a success, and Batman versus Superman was a colossal piece of you-know-what?
Batman versus Superman, as soon as I heard that, I said, that's clickbait. That's basically clickbait.
Right.
It cannot work. I don't care what they do. This cannot work.
Right.
Okay, because first of all, you have to convince me that these two fighters for justice are going to come to hate each other so much that they are going to come into conflict, and it's a conflict that I even believe.
To the death, right.
I don't believe that from point one, okay? So they already have got me with a massive problem of disbelief.
I'll tell you what, my wife, when she heard that, she's like, that's ridiculous. Superman could kill him. In a second, he just goes over and just done. It's over. Yeah.
That's the other reason.
Right.
You got a human against a god.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Right. And no matter how much tech you might have,
he's
still a god.
That's right. No matter how smart Batman may be,
right.
It's not going to happen.
Right.
This is the same problem why the Matrix 1 was so much better than 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as he becomes a superhero, a god in Matrix 2, the concept that this guy has any jeopardy at all is gone. You know, I always find that, you know, you look at these superhero movies when either the supervillain and the superhero have a fist fight,
mm-hmm.
or two superheroes have a fist fight, you know, and one guy gets punched and he knocks down three buildings, you know, and then he gets up.
Yes.
You know? It's like, it's just a total waste of time, because nobody for a second thinks that anybody's going to be hurt at all.
There's no jeopardy.
No.
There's no jeopardy. That's why a movie like Logan, you could feel that there was jeopardy. And finally, you know, with Wolverine, that he was sick, that he could do all this kind of stuff. And there was jeopardy in it. And Batman versus the Joker, you know, at any moment, Batman can get hurt.
Yeah.
And he does.
And the people he loves can get hurt.
Right.
And you had that great scene in the jail when Batman locks the door.
Mm-hmm.
And he had – and this is just another example of the Joker testing him morally, because – but she's saying to Batman, okay, Batman, how far are you going to go to get me to give you the information that you need in order to save your girlfriend and Harvey? And so he has to basically break the law, practically kill the guy. And then even then, the Joker is so damn smart. The exact person is located, and it's just brilliant from you know, minute one.
And without question. Now, you were saying something earlier though about television being so much better than film today. Why do you think that is? Because I agree with you 100%. But what is the reasoning, you think?
It's all in the story structure. And what you've seen in the last 15 to 20 years,
mm-hmm.
is TV moving from a generic episodic art form that is not even an art form to the storytelling medium that's probably the greatest storytelling medium that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from the fact that until about 20 years ago, the story structure of an episode of television was based on about 44 minutes where the same story structure beats were repeated. week in, week out. So you begin the story by establishing the problem, for example, the crime, and then the goal is to solve the crime, and then they solve the crime in the last scene, right?
Right.
End story. And then next week, we repeat those same beats. We just come up with a different vision. So what you get is generic storytelling. That is not an art form.
Mm-hmm.
Now, basically with The Sopranos, I mean, Bochco really started this about 10 years before that. But where it really changed was with The Sopranos, because with The Sopranos, we have the serial story structure instead of what used to be known as the standalone story structure.
Right.
Standalone, an episode is a standalone story, and we repeat that each time.
Mm-hmm.
Serial, what you have is you have, first of all, you tend to have multiple main characters. Each one has desires, but instead of the desire getting solved in each episode, these are desires that extend over an entire season. This then allows you to have opposition within the team of main characters. And this opposition doesn't get solved at the end of one episode. It extends over an entire season.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is that the standard of quality that by we judge the art form is not the episode, it's the season. And all of the great shows are serial story structure. And this serial story structure goes back to the novels of the mid-1800s, especially Charles Dickens.
All right.
We've basically gone back to the future. But what does that mean? It means we have on television, we have a canvas that is 10 times larger than we get in a feature film. That's why film has no chance to compete with on that level. And so and what that means is that we have far more complexity of character, mm-hmm. and far more complexity of plot.
So is that why there's so much more spectacle to try to hide that there's lack of story in Hollywood movies nowadays?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's based on a false assumption, one we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. that, oh, what gets him into the seats is all the special effects, all the spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's when I'm seeing a superhero movie, I better have some of that. No question about it. Mm-hmm. But that's not what gets him into the seats. The other reason that TV has far surpassed film is the economic model. Because the Hollywood studios are designed to appeal to a worldwide audience for each film, they have to make a very narrow form of story that appeals essentially to anywhere from 15 to 25 to 30 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Worldwide, okay? What does that mean? That means myth, warrior, superhero stories, right? That's where we can make our money. That's why I always tell writers, unless you're willing to write a superhero story, Hollywood doesn't want to talk to you. All they want is blockbusters. But what's the difference with television? Television fractured from the three channels.
Right.
Hundreds of channels and Netflix and Amazon all making narrow casting. I don't have to appeal when I make Breaking Bad or Mad Men. I don't have to appeal to a 15-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
I am appealing to a very intelligent segment of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a much more select audience than even at the major networks. Used to be you had to have a hit in the on a network show, you had to have 20 million viewers.
Right.
Mad Men, at the peak of its popularity, this is, in my opinion, the greatest TV show in history, and certainly one of the top five.
Mm-hmm.
It had 3 million viewers.
Wow.
Now, when you don't have to appeal to that mediocre audience,
mm-hmm.
that's in the middle, you can do things that stretch, that are not only great examples in and of themselves of a work of art, but they stretch the medium of television to being a medium that is at its highest art form. And so what you've seen really in the last 20 years is the same thing that happened to novels in about the mid-1700s when it became an art form. It happened in movies in the early 1900s when it became an art form. This happened at the beginning of this century with television. And what we've seen is what they call it, they rightfully call it the golden age of television, and it's because the writing is serial story structure, and guess what? The other key factor, writers control television. I absolutely despise the auteur theory that says the director is the author of the film. I think it's one of the biggest pieces of nonsense ever. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you prove it is look at the medium that has now come under the control of writers. Writers run it. Mm-hmm. Right? When you put writers in control of a story medium, guess what? You get great stories. When you put producers and directors in charge of a medium, like you get in film, guess what? You get spectacle, you get generic storytelling, and it doesn't reach the level of art. I was having dinner not too long ago with one of the top film critics in the country. I don't want to mention his name. Mm-hmm. One of the top film critics, won a Pulitzer, Scott. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I said to him, does it bother you that you are reviewing films every day that are primarily superhero films?
Right.
While television is going on, and for 15 years has been going on, that has one great show after another. Does that bother you? He says, every day of my life.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I could only imagine. Do you have any tips for writers to overcome the dreaded writer's block?
Absolutely.
Tell me.
Writer's block, again, is something that's highly misunderstood.
Okay.
Writers typically think that writer's block comes from a psychological problem that somebody has with their writing. In fact, writer's block is almost always caused by a structural problem that they have in their writing. When you solve the structural problem, you get rid of the block. What happens is that a lot of writers still go, in novel world, it's called being a pantser. It's plotting by the seat of your pants, just coming up with the plot as you go. And this is, by the way, the most common mistake that amateur writers make, and it holds them back tremendously from having a chance to write at the professional level. They come up with an idea. It's a great idea. They get so excited, they immediately start writing script pages. They write 15, 20 pages, write themselves into a structural hole, and they can't get out. And they have no idea how they got there. So they run into the block, and eventually they give up. And then they try it again. They repeat the same mistake with the next story idea until they screw up enough story ideas that they give up writing entirely. All right? And by the way, it ties in with this is one of the, I think, most dangerous pieces of fiction that writers have been given, which is just get it on the page. Right? Just get it down. Mm-hmm. You can fix it later. I used to give that recommendation myself because writer's block, you know, when it flows, go with it. Let it flow. Mm-hmm. Except that I found after years of experience that it doesn't flow forever. It stops flowing about page 15 and you can't get it to flow again. Mm-hmm. And so this is why I always say, no, do your due diligence up front. Do your structural work up front, your planning, your outlining, your figuring out the structural elements of your unique story, not the three-act type stuff, but I'm talking about the structural elements of your unique character and your unique plot. Get that grand design figured out up front. When you have that grand design in front of you, which you then will be able to adjust as you go, you're not restricted to it. You're not frozen to it. Mm-hmm. But when you have that grand design, I guarantee you will not hit writer's block.
Now, what is, you said about amateur writing, what is the biggest difference between a professional and an amateur?
Plot. It's the ability to write an intriguing, surprising plot that not only hits the main genre beats of the particular genre that author is working in, mm-hmm. but twists the beats in a unique way. And here we have to step back. Most writers don't even know the beats of the genre they're working in. And one of the things I have in the worksheet mm-hmm. has to do with these genres. One of them being that the most important marketing strategy, I talked about, you got to write for what Hollywood wants to buy. Mm-hmm. The single most important marketing strategy in Hollywood film and television, and also in novels, by the way, mm-hmm. is every film that is made is a mix of at least two, typically three, sometimes even four genres. It's the marketing strategy of giving two for the price of one. Mm-hmm. There is almost no single genre film out today. All right. So you got to start with that. And let's say you know that as a writer and you're mixing genres. Well, then you run into another problem. If you don't know how to mix the genres, then you end up with a big story mess because each one of those genres has its own specialized hero, its own specialized opponent. These are predetermined. Mm-hmm. It has each one has anywhere from 8 to 15 story beats, specialized plot beats that make that particular genre. For example, one of the plot beats that you get in a love story is the first kiss.
Right.
Now, if you don't have a first kiss in your love story, guess what? You're going to fail.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But so what writers do is they try to mix these genres and they end up with story chaos. And so, and again, this is something that I've got in the story worksheet, which is you have got to then, once you know what the genres are you're using, mm-hmm. you've mm-hmm. got to make one of those genres the primary genre, because that gives you the foundation structure, including the main desire line, that all the other genres and plot beats are going to be built on top of.
So I have a good example, I think, of one that worked well with combining genres, which is Logan, which is a superhero mixed with a Western,
yeah.
basically.
Mixed with a drama.
Mixed with a drama, yeah. A family drama, almost.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why it kicks it up to a higher level than the normal superhero story, mm-hmm. is because when you are doing your genres, mm-hmm. And I said you got to twist the genre, mm-hmm. the most important strategy for twisting those genre beats is to add drama elements, family drama elements. And that's because what drama does is these are real characters with real pain, real problem, and they are not superheroes that – you know, they're way up here, they're gods and so on. They don't have any weaknesses and so on. You combine genre with drama, you're going to have probably the most powerful drama genre combination there is. And Logan is a perfect example of that.
Now, where can you find an example where it went awry, where they mix genres and you're like, what happened? Could you say, go back to a superhero movie, Suicide Squad? Was that a mixture of genres? That was a mixture of a bunch of stuff.
It is, but my sense is that the reason for that failure was much more than just they didn't know how to mix the genres right. My sense was that wasn't the main problem with that. And it tied in with some of the things we talked about in terms of – and now it's interesting to look at what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. They were trying to use the technique I talked about before, which is – what do you do when you have superheroes, mm-hmm. to make them human and to make so we can identify with them more? Well, we make them really dark, negative superheroes. Mm-hmm. And that was a great idea. Mm-hmm. Problem is that what they were using is there is a subgenre called the suicide mission story.
Sure.
Rogue One is a suicide mission story. Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is a suicide, and 1 is a suicide mission story. Mm-hmm. And this is, by the way, the primary genre strategy that they use when they're doing superhero team movies. Mm-hmm. They use and Suicide Mission, I don't want to go into too much detail. I talk sure. about this in my genre classes, but Suicide Mission story is a sub-form of action. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you set up a team of people, they have a single goal, but the goal is so impossible to get that everybody's going to be killed by the end of the story. And they all know it going in.
Right.
Like, it's a suicide mission.
Seven Samurai.
That's the beginning.
Magnificent Seven, sure.
To this day is the greatest of all, and in my opinion, the greatest movie ever made. But that's another story.
Yes.
But there, you know, a good number of those people get killed. Mm-hmm. And here's the cheat that the modern superhero form of this does. Well, we can't kill off our superheroes because we've got to have them for the next movie.
Right.
So we take the form of a suicide mission story. But we don't kill them off, or we kill off just the superficial outside periphery type of characters that we can afford to get rid of.
Right. Right.
But again,
we don't have the rights to.
Right. But nobody gets fooled by that, right?
Right.
I mean, you get with Rogue One, you had a real suicide mission story, and you really felt when these guys, you know, like the,
yeah.
I mean, it was right out of Seven Samurai. But you know, you even had the samurai guy, the blind samurai guy.
Yeah. Someone made it.
Yeah, I mean, and when he dies, I mean, it hurts. It hurts.
Yes.
So it's a great form. But my point is that something like a Suicide Squad, a lot of the failure of that was embedded in the form, much like Batman versus Superman. There were certain things that they cannot overcome simply because they have to have repeating characters who cannot get killed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't there's just all kinds of things that we're restricted from doing with these stories.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But frankly, this problem of mixing genres the wrong way, you rarely see it on the actual screen mm-hmm. because they don't get that far. If you have story chaos in your script trying to mix genres, it never got made.
Right.
90% of the time.
Right. You
know? So the big problem with most of the films that get made is typically one of they don't hit these fundamental structure beats like desire, like setting up the opposition properly, that's so fundamental to a great story that it doesn't matter what the genre is. They lost the game much deeper.
Right.
Much earlier in the process when the entire frame of the story was set up in the wrong way.
Now, I'm going to ask you the last few questions that I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
That one's easy. You have to specialize in one genre. That doesn't mean you don't add other genres to your story, but you've got to specialize in a genre. And here's the reason. The popular storytelling today, I mentioned it's based on – each film is based on great narrative drive. But what creates that under the surface is the particular genre that you're working in. Mm-hmm. These genres are plot forms, and they are extremely complex. And therefore, and by the way, I've never seen it where a professional writer that I know in this town, and I know tons of professional writers in this town, mm-hmm. that they've been able to master more than one genre. So also, so the first reason you master one genre is because it's really hard to do that.
Right.
To write at the professional level in that genre. The second reason, though, is that's how you set yourself apart from the crowd. You become known, I'm the detective guy, right? I write detective stories. You wanted to, got to write your detective story, you got to come to me,
right?
I'm the comedy guy. That's all I write, but I'm really great at writing comedy. So when they're trying to figure out, well, who are we gonna hire to write this or rewrite this script, oh, he's the guy. He's the guy. And if we can get him, if we can pay him enough money, maybe we can get him.
So then there's some directors like Nolan who jumps genre every once in a while as well. But he's a director as well. So he kind of is well, a and beast.
Is one of the three most powerful popular writer directors in the world.
Right.
He can do whatever the hell he wants.
He's the Kubrick of his day.
Right. And we're not. That's the point that I tell, I always tell writers, your script, maximum 120 pages, but better if it's down to 100 to 110, because Hollywood only gives you 2 hours, mm-hmm. unless you're James Cameron.
Right.
And then you can write as long as you want, right?
When you make $3 billion,
guess what? You're not James Cameron.
Right.
You don't get to do that.
Now, can you tell me the book that tell me the book that had the biggest impact on your life or career?
The book that had the biggest impact on my life or career is what I consider the greatest book on story there is. It dwarfs everything else. I'm reluctant to tell you simply because it is highly philosophical. Mm-hmm. And when your listeners go to look at it, read it, they're going to look at that in the first 3-4 pages and say, are you kidding me? What? There's no way I'm going to read this. But if you do read it, it'll blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Greatest book on story ever written. It's called Anatomy of Criticism.
Okay.
By the guy by the name of Northrop Frye. Okay. And it makes guys like Aristotle and Joseph Campbell. I mean, these are great guys. These are all in the top five of masters of story. But this guy is up here, and everybody else is down here.
What's the name of it again?
It's called Anatomy of Criticism. And that's one reason why my book on story, which is called Anatomy of Story, mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. that title, is because it takes a similar approach in the sense that both books get into story really down at the technical level, very specific level, instead of, again, this very theoretical or esoteric stuff that nobody really knows how to apply.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally practical, totally useful. Now, his is much more esoteric because he's essentially writing the philosophy of story.
Mm-hmm.
His understanding of the hero and the history of the hero,
mm-hmm.
which is the first of 4 sections in that book,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing else that's close to that.
Interesting. Oh, I'm going to read it now. I'll let you know. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh, man. You probably should have asked me that one beforehand. I should give that a thought. Well, that's a tough one. It's a lesson that I continue to try to learn,
mm-hmm.
which is the beauty and the complexity of story.
Mm-hmm.
To me, and this is something I always say to writers, unless you're in for the long haul, get out now.
Amen.
Because this is the most complex craft in the world. Nothing else is close. And if you want to master that craft, that's a lifetime commitment. I've spent my whole life writing and understanding story,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not all the way there yet. Mm-hmm. I know a little bit about story, but there's a lot more for me to learn. And so I believe, and this also is something I strongly believe in, and I tell my students, which is you can, apply whatever your techniques are that mm-hmm. you're going to apply.
Mm-hmm.
But unless you are willing to really get to the level of mastery of craft,
mm-hmm.
right, then you're not going to succeed. Because, and this was the biggest surprise to me in all my years in Hollywood, which is that the most successful writers are not the most intrinsically talented. This blew me away when the first time I read it. Right. But the ones that succeed are the ones who have mastered the craft of writing. So that when a producer comes to hire you, they know this person's a professional. They are going to give me a professional script every time out. Because keep in mind, that's their biggest fear as a producer.
Mm-hmm.
Because producer is going into a black hole when they hire a writer. They have no control over it. They have no idea what they're going to get. If you have the track record and if you have proven that it doesn't matter what the job is, I always produce professional level material, then you are going to have more work than you ever thought possible, and you're going to make a ton of money because it is quite rare.
And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, wow. Another one I wish you had.
Well, Seven Samurai, you said.
Seven Samurai is right at the top. I, in my Anatomy of Story class, I teach, I talk about extensively about The Godfather.
Of course.
Which is just brilliant on every level and so instructive for learning to write. And another, just by the way, another argument that I make for the screenplay as art form, this idea that the screenplay is a blueprint for a director drives me up a wall. You know, read The Godfather script. That, I mean, it's just a joy. It's it, especially if you love story, if you love writing, you read that and it's just, you know, I've seen God.
Right.
So that's certainly up there. I think in terms of really the one of the most brilliant scripts of the last 20 years or so, it's a little bit more than that now, is Usual Suspects.
It was a great script.
Great script. Absolutely great script. That is a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier of not only hitting the story beats, but flipping every one of those story beats in a way that not just a little bit, that just blows your mind. And you don't realize how much he's flipped every story beat until the very last moment of the film.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
That's great, right?
It is very
and
good.
And that's a perfect example of the power of someone who can plot. This guy, that's somebody who understands plot at as high a level as you can get. And when you can have your final big reveal in the last scene, which very few films can do that,
you
can do that, they will anoint you as the next god, and you are made for the rest of your life.
Well, that is exactly what happened to Christopher – I forgot his last name.
Yeah. What was it?
McCurry, something like that?
Yeah. Gosh, I should know that. I'm embarrassed that I don't know that.
But he pretty much started doing whatever he wanted after that movie.
Yeah. Another guy who's a writer-director, but he really sets himself apart is in the writing is this guy McDonough. He did In Bruges.
The one with yes, I know who you're talking about.
Ray Fiennes and a couple of those other Irish English guys.
Yes.
You know, wow. Again, you want to see textbook great writing? Take a look at that script. So those are four right there that you know, and I could go on with a few others.
I
tend to tell you the truth because I put so much emphasis on genre. When people ask me that question, I usually say, what genre? And usually try to come up with one or two in each form. Because the trick, you know, I was talking about master a genre. The trick is, once you've chosen your genre, then go to the best in that form.
Yes.
And break them down.
Yes.
Break them structurally. Do a scene list of these things. And then look to see how they are structured. What's the underlying structure to the scene list? And when you do that, you will start to see how great that genre can be when you're hitting on all cylinders.
Now, you've been talking about this worksheet you did for the Indie Film Hustle Tribe. Where can they download this worksheet?
That can be downloaded at Truby.com. It's T-R-U-B-Y, Truby.com/worksheet.
Okay, fantastic.
I guarantee your listeners that you go through those, fill in the space for your particular story. I guarantee you the narrative drive on your story will immediately improve quite a bit. I promise you.
And I will put that link in the show notes as well. John, it has been an epic interview. I know we could talk for another 2 hours, if not longer.
I'd love to. You're a great interviewer, Alex. I really enjoyed this.
I appreciate it. Thank you again, my friend. We'll talk soon.
As I promised you guys, John brought the thunder. You know, he really, I mean, for me at least, changed my perspective on the hero's journey, and what it means, and just his whole take on storytelling is so remarkable. So I really hope you guys got something out of John's stuff. And if you want to get that worksheet, just head over to truby.com/worksheet. And if you want links or John's direct contacts, just head over to indiefilmhustle.com/BPS001. That's Bulletproof Screenplay, or BPS001. And that'll be the new tag for all of the show notes for the Bulletproof Screenplay podcast. So thank you for listening. Thank you, Tribe. That's across, since it's been a crossover event. I know a lot of the Tribe are listening to this episode, so please subscribe. Head over to screenwritingpodcast.com. It'll take you straight to iTunes and subscribe to this podcast. You'll be getting now not one, not two, but three podcasts every week from Indie Film Hustle. Two from Indie Film Hustle and one from the Bulletproof Screenplay. I'm really trying to create as much value and content for you guys as humanly possible. And please spread the word. So now that you're done listening to this episode, obviously go listen to the rest of them. But when you're done, never stop writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenplay podcast at bulletproofscreenplay.com. That's BULLETPROOFSCRENPLAY.com.